New on CuriosityStream. Grab your lab goggles. We're out to find the world's coolest, loudest, and most in-your-face experiments.
Wow! That's impressive.
See how hands-on science can change our everyday lives on Oddly Satisfying Science. Plus, from goats to guard dogs, hear surprising stories about the creatures that brought humanity to the next level. It's animals that changed history. Watch now on CuriosityStream. Annual plans are $20, just $1.67 a month. Visit CuriosityStream.com.
I work at the crappy gas station at the edge of town. Weird things happen here. I had a blog for a while, before mysterious powers shut it down. And somewhere along the way, I pissed off a bunch of very bad people. Oh, and I can't sleep. Yep, that pretty much sums it all up. Everything else is just details. I guess apologies are in order for any of you who are waiting to hear back from me. I've been a little busy lately. I'm still working at that crappy gas station at the edge of town, and these days I'm running things all by myself. Yeah, everyone else is gone now. Jerry was the first to leave. Not gonna lie, that sucked more than I was expecting. Rosa wasn't too far behind him, and Amy, she was the last holdout, but eventually, even she couldn't stay here any longer. Her replacement was an overweight Italian guy named Deputy Harold Love. He drops by once a week or so to make sure the place hasn't burned all the way down, but besides that, he and I don't really hang out much. Even my longtime torturer Spencer seems to have gone dark on me. I haven't gotten a threatening phone call or surprise attack in months. Now, of course, there's a decent chance that he and Detective Riggin finally managed to kill one another, and if that's the case, I probably won't lose any sleep over it. That was a joke, by the way. I'm not likely to lose any sleep no matter what. I'm trying my damnest to keep things lighthearted right now. After all, as my recently deceased psychiatrist once said, a little gallows humor never hurt anybody. Plus, if I don't find some way to laugh, I just might lose what's left of my notoriously fragile mind. To be fair, I'm not completely alone here. There's that disembodied head in an ice chest behind the counter. He can be quite the chatterbox sometimes. Plus, I still get the occasional customer, although sales have slowed down quite a bit following the organization's efforts to strangle us out of business. We only get deliveries once a month now, and I can't even remember the last time our pumps had any gas in them. Are you lost? That's probably my fault. My mind isn't as sharp as it used to be. Sometimes I forget what I'm saying and go off on little tangents. Sometimes the head in the ice chest has to remind me to stop telling the customers my entire life story and just ring them up and get them out of here already. It's not safe having anyone else in the store. He reminds me quite often. It's not safe for them or us. Anyone coming in could be part of the invasion. But I don't think they're going to send anyone else to kill me. I think they realize that this is siege warfare, and the best thing for them to do is sit tight and wait me out. It's a brilliant plan, and it looks like it's working. I haven't left the gas station in a long time. Supplies are thin, and reinforcements are not on the way. Sorry. Where was I again? Oh, right. You're probably wondering how things got this bad, aren't you? Well, to borrow a cliche, it's a long story. I didn't lose it all at once. I think things started way back in February when a man came into the store and asked me to tell him the scariest story I knew. This was before Jerry left. I had just heard that there was a good chance I might soon be getting a new fancy pants prosthetic to replace the crutches I'd been using ever since I lost my real leg in a nasty work-related accident a couple months earlier. Long story. The owners of the gas station decided to give me a modest pay raise, their way of saying sorry and please don't sue us. One of the stalkers trying to kill me had just been sucked into a nightmare-held dimension. Short story. And to top it all off, the traveling carnival was coming to town. To be honest, things were going pretty well. I'd made the mistake of growing complacent, of taking it all for granted. Jerry and Rosa and Amy had started to make me think that my life was almost normal. Hell, I'd go so far as to say I was actually happy and looking forward to the future. I was wrapping up another 16-hour shift when a man came into the gas station. By all accounts, he seemed pretty unremarkable. His entire appearance was, in a word, forgettable. He wore a generic suit and tie of gray or blue. He had generic medium-length, darkish brownish hair. He stood somewhere between 5'8 and 6'2". His generic face was completely ordinary. He had two arms, two legs, you get the point. I barely registered him as a background character, and after he entered, I quickly tuned him out. Rosa showed up to work with a big, excited smile on her face, a good 15 minutes before her shift was supposed to start, and ran up to the counter where I was seated. "Good morning, sunshine." I returned her smile and put away the book I'd been working on. "Hey, Rosa." She always seemed a little happier than what made sense to me. I'd never met another employee so excited to come into work at the crappy gas station. But Rosa was nothing if not perpetually cheerful. She walked up to me and dropped an old paperback on the counter, exclaiming, "I loved this book. It was so good." I laughed. She was referring to the campy sci-fi drama that I'd loaned her a couple days earlier. One of my very favorites. Highly entertaining, but not a good book by any stretch of the imagination. "I'm glad you liked it," I said. "It's actually the first in the series." Her eyes lit up. "Really?" "Yeah, but they kind of get progressively worse with each installment. I wouldn't get too excited if I were you." "Well, if you loan me the next one, I can pay you back with coffee sometime." "Yo, nerds!" We both looked up to see Jerry walking through the doorway. He was wearing sunglasses, a gray hoodie, and a white t-shirt that read, "My name is Jerry," in big, bold lettering. In one hand, he had a 40-ounce styrofoam cup with a red straw poking out, and smart money would say the contents of that container were alcoholic. In the other, he held a small greeting card. Before we could form a response, he was already next to us. He dropped the card on the counter, next to the book, and then said, "You'll sign this card I made for Leroy?" "You made Leroy a card?" I asked with an unshakable, overwhelming sense of deja vu. "That's so sweet," Rosa chimed in before picking it up and reading it out loud. "Hey, Leroy, sorry you got your arm ripped off by a giant tentacle monster." "Oh, look, he drew a picture of it and everything." "What can I say?" Jerry took a long swig of his drink, then continued, "I'm a really caring kind of guy." "Hang on," I said. "Do either of you get the feeling that we've been here before? That we've done this already?" "Nope," Jerry retorted without even giving it any thought. I suppose it could have just been my broken brain playing tricks on me again. "Excuse me," said the generic man in a deep, calm, soothing voice, like that of a late-night radio show host. "Okay," I said. "I'm looking for Jeremy Pascal." "Are you now?" I asked. "That's right. I understand he works here." We all stood in an awkward silence. Jerry and I stared at the man. The man stared back. Rosa cut her eyes between each of us, trying to figure out what was going on. Then, after a painfully long standoff, Jerry lifted the drink to his mouth and emptied it through the straw, swallowing loudly with each gulp, and finally finishing with that annoying, scratchy noise that straw makes when a drink is about done. You know the one. "Are you..." The man was cut off by the sound of more loud slurping. Once Jerry was finished, the man tried again. "Are you Jeremy Toulouse Pascal?" "Nope," said Jerry. The man reached into his coat pocket and retrieved a photograph. He looked at it, then at Jerry, then back at it, and then he put it away. I didn't catch a peek at the photo, but it doesn't take a genius to know he wasn't looking at a Marmaduke comic. "Can you tell me when Jeremy is expected to begin his shift?" Jerry shifted his eyes at me and answered, "I think that dude quit like a week ago." "Sorry," the man said. "I didn't catch your name." "Leroy," said Jerry. The man looked at Jerry's shirt, then at Jerry's face. Jerry took it a step further, picking up the card to Leroy and making a big demonstrative act of reading it before looking me in the eyes and saying, "Wow, Jack, thank you for this amazing card. So kind of you. And the artwork. Nothing short of superbitude." The man sighed, turned around, and left the gas station. "What was that about?" asked Rosa, just like I knew she would. "Don't worry about it. If anyone asks, my name is Leroy now." He pulled off his shirt and hoodie and threw them both to the ground. Amazingly, he managed to do the whole action without displacing his sunglasses or styrofoam cup. Then, as he stood there shirtless like a moron, he exhaled loudly and said, "Man, it sure is drafty in here." Rosa politely diverted her eyes. "I think I have an extra t-shirt somewhere in my car that you can borrow. Jack, you want to come with me and help me look?" "Actually," I answered, "I need to talk to Leroy here before I head out for the day. Do you mind?" She smiled and put up her hand to stop me and said, "Say no more. I'll be right back." Then she left. Jerry, still shirtless, walked around the counter and grabbed a pack of smokes off the wall. I noticed that he'd finally gone through with that plan to turn the bullet wound on his back into another tattoo. He settled on a flower, with petals emerging from the round lump of scar tissue. "What's up, Buttercup?" he asked. "I see that Eric's back in town, huh?" He stared at me. I couldn't exactly tell what that stare was supposed to mean. Maybe he was working up a good response. Maybe he just remembered he'd left the stove on. But after a second or two, he answered, "Yeah, he's visiting for a couple days, so what?" "Eric used to be a local, but he got out of town years ago. I never knew him. But when we leave, we lose our identity, and all we are is whatever we leave behind, right?" "I think Jean-Paul Sartre said something along those lines. My point is, I didn't know Eric, but I did know his niece, Vanessa. Vanessa was another coworker and a mutual friend of ours, until one day, a couple months back, when she got fed up with the small-town life. She ran away and left a note saying she wanted to go find herself. But after a few weeks, it was the state police that found her. She'd gotten lost on a walking trail, broke her leg, and died from exposure. Or at least, that was the official story. Jerry and I knew something was off, and not just because we were present when the EMTs pulled her lifeless body out of the gas station wall. The agents that showed up the next day were both specific and vivid in their threats of what would happen if anyone challenged the official story, and finished the whole thing off with a polite reminder that nobody would ever believe us if we tried to tell the truth. But that was before her hard-ass uncle showed up again out of the blue, making crazy threats and trying to get himself killed. I know we all grieve in our own ways, but he struck me as the sort that was out for blood. All in all, it was another distraction that I had no interest in getting involved in, but he'd come by earlier that day looking for Jerry for some reason. I'm just saying, I don't think you should get involved in whatever he has planned. Don't worry, dude. I'm not going to do anything stupid, he said, waving his hands in the air to demonstrate what stupid looks like. Somehow, I didn't find his assurance all that reassuring. Wow, said the man standing on the other side of the counter. We both turned to look at him. I wish I had a picture of this. I'd put it in my employee handbook under how not to behave when customers are in the store. He was a 50-something-year-old man in a white sport coat and a blue button-up with hazel eyes surrounded by wrinkles. Above and below, like he was accustomed to staring into the sun. The color of his eyes matched his short brown hair, freshly cut and combed, and dapper, like he was on his way to a job interview at a 1950s haberdashery. He was heavy in that rich old man way, not fat. No, poor people are fat. He was a seemingly fake and television-y accent. And when he spoke, it was with an extra southern drawl like a watered-down Colonel Sanders. It was a seemingly fake and television-y accent, like how people who have never been to the South think Southerners are supposed to sound. It was unnerving. I guess he was probably referring to the fact that Jerry was totally showing nip. Can I help you with something? I asked, hoping he would say no and leave the store forever. He inspected the tiered spinning rack of pork rinds, pulled off a bag and flipped it over, then returned it to the display and said, "I usually don't do this part of the job myself. Most of the time, I send one of my regional VPs, but after everything I read about this place, I couldn't believe it. I had to come down here and see for myself. My name is Francis Howard, and I'm considering buying it." He handed me a business card that read simply, "Francis Howard, MD," with a telephone number underneath. I assumed the MD meant he was a doctor, and not from Maryland, although those aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, are they? I gave the card to Jerry to throw away and asked, "Buying what?" "This gas station. Take a look at your surroundings. All I see is untapped potential. I think we can turn it around and get a serious return on the investment." Well, this was certainly one of the weirder encounters I'd had. "I don't think the owners are inclined to sell." "Well, that's where you're wrong, son. We've been in negotiations ever since the new year. They wanted to keep a lid on it. But now that we're close to making a deal, I thought it was high time I come by and introduce myself. You must be Jack, right? I've heard an awful lot about you. And I guess that would make this half-naked fellow here..." "Leroy," Jerry interjected. "Sup?" "Okay then, Leroy. Is there a good reason you're not following the dress code?" "Hey, you're right, Doc. I'm sorry. I really shouldn't have been wearing these sunglasses, but I just had eye surgery following a horrible ocular injury I sustained pushing a small child out of the way of a speeding bus." "I was referring to the fact that you're exposing your bare chest." "What?" Jerry yelled. "I'm not wearing a shirt?" He put his hands over his nipples and bellowed at full volume. "Damn my eyes! I had no idea I left home today without my shirt. Why didn't anyone tell me?" He reached back to the dirty magazine rack and grabbed one and pushed it into the doctor's hands. "Here, as my token of sincere apologetitude, please take this porno." The man looked at the magazine, then at me. Not sure what he expected from me. I just gave him a look that said, "You're on your own." Because I knew something about Jerry that he didn't. I knew a power struggle with Jerry is a fool's errand, because he doesn't play to win. He plays to make sure everybody else loses. But the doctor kept his cool, putting the pornographic magazine under his arm and saying, "I feel like there are going to be some big changes once I take over. Normally I like to hire a local manager to oversee my properties, but I've got a feeling I'm going to be a little more hands-on with this one." Rosa came back inside, walked around the doctor, and handed Jerry a pink t-shirt. "Here you go. It might be a little small, but it's the only one I could find." When she noticed the man on the other side of the counter, she smiled politely and said, "Hello, are you finding everything okay?" "Wow, three employees," Dr. Howard scoffed. "Why does it take three of you to run a place like this? You can definitely expect some staffing adjustments once the sale goes through." Rosa stared at him with big, confused eyes, the way a deer stares at an oncoming meteor, and uttered one word. "What?" "In the meantime," he said, "I think you three need to take a step back and take a good, long, hard look in the mirror and ask yourselves, am I really doing the best job I can?" "Yeah?" Jerry responded. "Well, I think you need to step back and take a good, long, hard gorilla dick and use it to go screw yourself." The doctor did his best to hide the rage pressure cooking inside of him, but I could see where it was tearing at the seams. He faked a smile, then turned and walked out the store. Just before he got through the doors, Jerry screamed out at the top of his lungs, "Enjoy that freaky weird porno, Dr. Howard!" The doctor stopped for a split second, like he was going to turn around and respond. But then he continued outside to where a stretch Hummer was parked waiting for him, climbed into the back seat, and rode off. That a-hole didn't even buy any gas from us. Once he was gone, I looked at Jerry and asked, "You know that an erect gorilla penis is only a couple inches long, right?" He made a sour face and shook his head like he'd just bit into an electric lemon. "No, no. Why would anyone know that? Why do you know that?" He shivered and went outside for a smoke. Rosa picked up his clothes and started tidying the place up, despite the fact that she wasn't even on the clock yet. I took the opportunity to call and speak with the owners, who assured me that they had absolutely no intention of ever selling the gas station. Dr. Howard had made them several offers, and they had repeatedly turned him down. He finally told them to name their price, which must be why he was so sure the sale was going to happen. What he didn't know, though, was that the owners were never interested in being rich or even turning a profit at all. Anyone with eyes could see that this place hemorrhaged money on the daily. I don't know how the owners could afford to pay what must be astronomical insurance premiums and still keep the lights running. But I always assumed that it was just one of those things. Look, I'm a simple guy. I run the cash register. I don't question how or why this place is still open. But if I were to begin asking questions, a good place to start might be, why does the doctor want to own this shithole so badly? I reconciled my cash drawer, grabbed my crutches, and clocked out. After that, I sat in the booth seat next to the doors waiting for Amy. Deputy Amelia O'Brien, to come pick me up. In the meantime, I started talking to Rosa. You know, she said, the carnival is in town. I heard. It was the same weird carnival that comes every year around this time. They set up on the old fairgrounds past the railroad tracks, bringing big tents and shows and rides of questionable safety standards and edible fried garbage. The locals love it, and the gas station gets a big boost from the extra traffic. Well, I'm not doing anything on Wednesday. At first, all I could think was that was a weirdly specific thing for her to say. Any significance of the date had completely escaped me. Okay, I said. I don't know if you had any plans for that day either. As a rule, I generally don't make plans. With a lifespan like mine, long term usually doesn't factor into the question, and I find it much safer to live each day as if it could be my last. But not in a YOLO kind of way. More of a rather just sit right here in the relative safety of the moment and read a book kind of way. Sure, that probably sounds pretty pathetic, but that's just because it really is. And I don't care. I'd have to check the work schedule, I told her. I already did, she said. Neither of us are working that night. Oh, okay. Well? Well, what? Do you want to go to the carnival with me? I weighed the question over in my mind. I hadn't been to the carnival since I was a child. The last time I went, I barfed on a carny and got separated from my foster family. I vaguely remember getting lost, trying to take a shortcut through the woods, and finally hitchhiking back into town a few hours later. I was 8 or 9 at the time. Jerry walked out of the bathroom and announced, "The mirror leg is getting a lot worse. I think it's about time to replace it again." He must have sensed something was going on from the looks on our faces, because the next thing he said was, "Hey, what are you guys talking about? I can sense something is going on from the looks on your faces." Rosa asked if I wanted to go to the carnival on Wednesday. Jerry made that face he makes when he's pretending to think. Then he said, "You know what? That sounds like fun. I'd love to go." Right about then, O'Brien walked into the store. She nodded at the others and said, "Rosie, Shaggy," then to me, "You ready?" Before I could answer, Jerry blurted out, "O'Brien should totally come with." "Come with you where?" "Wednesday night. We're all going to the carnival together." "On Valentine's Day?" she asked. "Oh, that's right. Wednesday is Valentine's Day. Wait a second. Was Rosa asking me out on a date?" "You sure that's a good idea? There's still at least one psychopath stalker out there trying to hunt you down and kill you." "It'll be fun," Jerry replied. "We can all meet up here at 8 and ride together in the cop car. Sound good, Rosa?"
"Oh, yeah, I guess."
"Cool beans," he said. Then, as he walked back out the front doors, Jerry yelled, "I call shotgun!" That night, when I returned from my overnight shift, Jerry was already there. Or maybe he was still there. He doesn't leave all that often. He and Rosa were sitting next to each other behind the counter, playing chess with those pieces he carved out of soap. He was still wearing Rosa's pink t-shirt, with Leroy's old name tag pinned over his heart. I counted down Rosa's till while they wrapped up their game, not sure who won. And after she left, I pulled out my laptop to continue working on the book.
Before I could get started, the old madman-looking doctor approached the other side of the counter and cleared his throat. I looked up at him and said, "Doctor, welcome back. Can I help you with something?" He placed a hammer on the counter in front of me without saying a word. I rang it up like a good employee and gave him his total. He went to hand me his card, but as I reached for it, he pulled it away. "What are you working on?" he asked. "Oh, I'm writing my memoirs." Not sure why I answered him honestly. I guess I just didn't have any reason to lie.
"Is that a fact?"
"Well, it's not just my opinion."
"Are you a storyteller, Jack?"
Jerry chimed in.
"Jack's the best storyteller."
I had literally forgotten that Jerry was sitting right next to me until that moment. The man gave a wry smile and asked, "Do you know any scary stories?" I laughed, and Jerry continued singing my undeserved praises.
"Jack has the best scary stories to rock your socks off. Tell him about the time I peed a demon back to hell.
Oh, or that time we had to fight off zombie nudists. Or that time you were a vampire for a week." I elbowed him in the shoulder and said, "I've told you 100 times that last one never happened." He smiled and said,
"Sure it didn't. Wink."
Yes, he actually said the word wink. The doctor leaned over the counter and asked, "Pardon me if I'm out of line with this question, but what's the scariest story you know?"
"Not sure. Maybe you can read my book when it's done."
He laughed a good, chilling movie villain kind of laugh and said, "How about I tell you boys one? If it's not the scariest story you've ever heard, I'll even never come back. I'm sure you'd like that, right?"
"Yeah," I answered truthfully.
Jerry asked, "What if it is?" I felt like that question was wholly unnecessary. Working at the crappy gas station at the edge of town has left us with a completely warped definition of scary. Whatever the doctor could come up with, I was confident it couldn't hold a candle to what we had already been through.
"Well," he replied, "if my story terrifies you like no other, if my story is too scary for you, then I say you pay for this hammer and we call it a night."
Jerry chuckled and said, "You're on, moron."
"Well," the doctor began, "like all of the best tales, this one is a completely true story."
Jerry laughed, but I didn't. Something about this man's sense of confidence was leaving me completely unsettled. He continued,
"This is the story of two young men, not unlike yourselves, brothers. They came from a very privileged, well-to-do New England family. Old money, you know the type. They were both accepted into an Ivy League college, where they got along just fine. But by all accounts, they had a perfect life. One day during spring break, the two brothers decide to take their lovely girlfriends on an extended vacation to their summer home in the Rockies. However, at the end of the trip, only 3 people returned." I couldn't tell where this story was going, but so far it seemed boring.
I turned to Jerry to see if he shared my opinion, but one look at his face told me he was hearing a completely different tale than I was. His skin was white. His heart was beating hard enough that I could see the pulse bouncing in his neck, and he was starting to sweat hard. Theory swirled about what happened to the missing brother. Unfortunately, the remaining witnesses proved unreliable. The police investigation stalled and they closed it as a cold case. The man's smile was sinister. "But I know what happened.
What actually happened.
And I know why he wants to remain missing." Jerry pushed me away from the cash register, opened it up, and pulled out a 20, before slapping it on the counter and yelling, "You win! Terrible scary story! I don't even want to know what happens next!" He reached over the counter and grabbed the doctor by the lips and squeezed them with his thumb and forefinger and said, "Shush!" The doctor smacked Jerry's hand away and said, "Don't put your dirty fingers anywhere near my mouth, you heathen!"
Jerry grabbed the hammer and pushed it into the doctor's hand. Then he took off Leroy's name badge, dropped it on the floor and said, "Hey, Jack, I've got to clock out and go home early. I just remembered I left my cat on fire."
I told him, "You were never on the clock."
"Even better," he exclaimed before speed walking around the corner and out the back door.
I turned my attention back to the doctor.
What was that?
He laughed again and turned to leave, but not without one final admonition.
"I'll be seeing you around, Jack." A few hours later, the store phone rang, and my palms started sweating. My spidey senses, or maybe just a Pavlovian response. I developed a subconscious dread every time that noise cuts into my peaceful solitude. A ringing store phone almost never brings good news. Sometimes it's my stalker, Spencer, calling to taunt me and warn that he's getting closer. But ever since I put a bullet in his stomach, the shortcut way, he hasn't had too much to say. Nevertheless, a ringing store phone has to be answered, and I'm nothing if not a good employee. So I took a deep breath and picked up.
Hello? Jack. A woman's voice. Yes? It's me.
Me who? Who the hell do you think?
O'Brien. I didn't recognize her because she almost never calls me by my real name. Only when things are really serious. This wasn't a good sign.
Sorry, what's up? Is everything okay there?
Yeah, why?
You're not being held hostage or anything, are you? If so, you can cough into the phone and I'll know.
I'm not being held hostage at the moment, but is there some reason you suspect I should be?
I'm 10 miles from you at a crime scene down by Dead Man's Curve. We got two bodies, unidentified. Looks like it might be just a regular car accident, but things don't really add up.
That's unfortunate, but I don't see what that has to do with me.
They don't have any ID, car isn't registered, no license, yada yada. You know how things go around here.
Sure.
But they did have one thing on them. A cell phone. Looks like it's a pay-as-you-go deal, but we'll send it to the lab to see if we can trace the original buyer.
Okay.
Unless for some reason I need to make sure it doesn't find its way to the lab.
Why would you do that?
I checked the call history before we bagged it. Jack, there are only two numbers that this phone has called over the last 2 years.
Okay. Still not sure where you're going with this.
One is the gas station. The other is your cell phone.
All at once it hit me.
Oh, I said. Well, want to point me in the right direction?
I know who the bodies are.
You going to keep me waiting for dramatic effect?
Sorry, my mind was swimming. This time my spidey senses were right. This was bad news. Very bad news. I think that you just found the owners of the gas station.
Sorry for that abrupt ending earlier. Somebody came into the store, so I had to put my laptop away and put my game face on. He asked if I knew that the pumps weren't working. I was totally prepared to put him down with my trusty baseball bat. But the disembodied head in the box assured me he was just a regular old boring human customer. Oh, I bet that probably comes as a surprise. Yeah, these days I keep a baseball bat under the counter at all times. I had to use it way more than you'd expect. Don't worry, I don't just go around cracking skulls all willy-nilly. I only attack someone if the head in the box identifies them as part of the invasion. I mean, I'm not some kind of lunatic. Anyway, the guy bought some gum and left, so I can get back to telling the story. Where was I again? O'Brien asked if I didn't mind coming down to identify the bodies of the owners. But I explained to her that I wouldn't be much help. Truth was, I'd never actually met the owners in person, and I had no idea what they looked like. I only knew them from their voices. They were a weird couple, husband and wife. I didn't know their real names, but they insisted we call them Mama and Pops. I have met their daughter, though, but that's a story for much later. O'Brien let me know that this was probably going to be written up in the official documentation as another run-of-the-mill accident. But off the record, she knew something was up. There was no logical reason to think that it was going to be related to me or the gas station, but come on, what are the chances this won't have anything to do with the gas station? I promised her I'd be careful and she disconnected. When I looked back up, Jerry was standing on the other side of the counter, wearing a bad fake mustache and that pair of Coke bottle glasses from the lost and found box.
Hey, I said, I thought you'd left.
Jack, he responded, it's me, Jerry. He pulled off the glasses and the mustache.
Yeah, I know. You're still wearing Rose's pink shirt. What do you...
Never mind. Can I just ask what the hell is going on?
I need to tell you something.
That's literally what you're doing, so good job so far.
No, not here.
He slowly turned and eyed the display of lawn gnomes by the door.
Meet me in the walk-in cooler in 5 minutes.
Ah, I swear to dark God, Jerry, if you're about to tell me that there's a dead body in the trunk of your car, I'm gonna lose it.
Relax, he said. What I have to tell you is way more interesting than that.
I rolled my eyes and set the egg timer to 5 minutes. Jerry reapplied his disguise and went outside for a smoke. As soon as the doors closed, our store phone rang again. I didn't even hesitate to pick it up, assuming it would be O'Brien again. Hello? The person on the other end of the line took a long, deep sigh. This was not O'Brien. I repeated my greeting, a little slower this time.
Hello?
Hey, Jack. It's FJ. Thought it was about time I gave you a courtesy call. FJ was Farmer Jr., a guy from town who used to relentlessly pester me about a crop of hand plants growing out back by the dumpster. I hadn't heard from him since he stopped ordering his bulk animal feed from us, and I assumed he'd finally moved on to another obsession. What can I do for you, FJ?
I want you to know that you're a real piece of crap.
He took a pause. I guess he was giving me a turn to respond. Okay, I said. Thanks for calling. Before I could hang up, he went into his rant. It sounded like it had been building up inside of him for a while, fermenting like a batch of moonshine and now full of poison and passion. My family gave you all our business for years, and we ain't never trying to screw you over. And you sit up there judging us, acting like you want to do right by us. But you ain't nothing but another asshole that thinks he's better than everybody. You ain't even man enough to tell me to my face that you got more ham plants sitting behind the store. Now I offered to pay you. You could have done right. You could have done the right thing. But you lied. Because you're too stupid to know what a good deal looks like. I ought to kick your ass for being so stupid.
Farmer, I told you, the hand plants are gone.
Yeah, they're gone. Now, even if they weren't, that ship has sailed. You know how much money he was going to give me for those? All I needed was a dozen of them and I could have retired rich. That's a once-in-a-lifetime deal. And now it's over because you're a stupid, lying piece of crap. And next time I see you, I'm going to mess you up.
I never did find out what it was Farmer wanted those hand plants for. I just assumed it was some kind of weird sex thing. This revelation that he was trying to sell them was more than a little surprising. I may have sought more details if he didn't seem so angry and drunk. Instead, I tried to wrap up the conversation while the wrapping was good.
Okay, well, I should get back to work.
Screw you, Jack.
It was nice catching up. I'm gonna kick your teeth in.
I'll talk to you later.
You better watch your back, because I'm coming for you.
Good night, FJ.
Good night.
I zipped up my jacket and dug my hands into my pockets to try and keep from shivering.
Okay, I said, watching my words turn to clouds in front of my face.
I think we've got the temperature set to low in here.
Jerry didn't seem to mind the cold.
So here's the thing, he started. I paid for Van's funeral.
I stared at him for a second, trying to think of the right question to ask. Finally, I came up with why. We'd gone to Vanessa's service a few days after they found her body. She and Jerry were close, closer than I'd seen him with anyone. And even though I had certain reasons for not wanting to go to yet another funeral, I tagged along for moral support. I own exactly one black suit, which I purchased several months earlier in anticipation for another upcoming funeral, but I haven't even tried it on. It had just been hanging there in my closet like a dark omen with a note attached for whoever ends up going through my things after I'm gone. I went ahead and put it on for Vanessa's service, and I was surprised to find that it fit perfectly. Jerry wore a tuxedo t-shirt and tricked me into taking a few shots and accidentally getting drunk beforehand. Not surprisingly, awkwardness ensued. He tried to wing a eulogy that nobody asked him to give, and O'Brien had to escort us both away from the scene.
The whole thing was kind of a blur, but I do remember thinking to myself that her funeral seemed a little fancy for a fellow minimum wage gas station orphan. I just assumed that she had some wealthy relative I didn't know about. Jerry gave a shrug and said, I wanted this town to see that she had people who cared enough about her to keep her from having a pauper's McFuneral. If I had more time, I would have gotten somebody famous to show up and really confuse the other guests, like Prince or David Bowie. Okay, and next question, how? Oh, he continued, so here's something you don't know about me. He took a deep breath. I'm kind of rich. Jerry, I pieced it together from Dr. Douchebag's story. I'm not an idiot. I know you had a pass before you ended up in the mathematics program. I'm asking how you got a hold of enough money to pay for Vanessa's funeral. Before I decided to take my sabbatical, I squirreled a little extra funding into a savings account. I thought it was safe, but I guess they were watching it after all. Now I think they're sending people to find me. Who's they? My parents. Hello? Somebody was calling from the front of the store. I told Jerry to hold that thought and went back out to the front to see two burly men in camo jackets and sunglasses. They were strapped and wearing flak vests that read, Fugitive Recovery Agent. They looked absolutely ridiculous, like real-life action figures. There were plenty of good reasons for bounty hunters to be poking around the gas station. People in this town were known for collecting warrants and trying to vanish. Spencer, Bo, my third-grade English teacher, any number of locals. But whatever they were doing in here, they didn't stick around too long. The first guy paid for their gas, while the second scoped out our hot dog roller. When they finally left, I went back to the walk-in cooler to let Jerry know that it was safe for him to come out. Jerry loaded up on beer, chips, and jerky, then he left. I didn't see him again for the rest of the night. About an hour later, the phone rang, as usual. My heart started beating funny. I answered. Hello? Another voice from my past. Hello, shithead. I sighed. What do you want, Bo? I wanted to let you know that I was right all along. You thought you'd won, but now I'm more powerful than you can even imagine. Do you want to know where I am right now? I already knew he was going to say something stupid like, I'm right outside, or I'm in the building, or I can see the look on your face. Bo was always pathetic and predictable, even when he was still alive. But I didn't feel like giving him the satisfaction. Hello, I said again. Are you still there, Bo? Yes, I'm still here, and I wanted to let you know that... Hello? I interrupted. You're breaking up. I can barely hear you. He grunted. I was trying to say that. It sounds like you're underwater. I was saying... Can you hear me? Hello? Hello? Jack? Oh, I can hear you now. Go ahead. I was saying that I'm more powerful than you could ever imagine, and now I... Hang on one second. What? I have another call coming in. You what? Do you mind if I put you on hold for just a second? Really? Yeah, it'll just be one second. He grunted again. Fine. Okay, I'll be right back. I put the phone down next to the receiver, which is where I left it for the rest of the night. Then I cracked open a new book to pass the time until the sun came up. We met up at the gas station before the sun went down on Wednesday. Rosa was the first to arrive. But she didn't look like she was even close to ready for the cold. She was wearing a knee-length yellow dress and light blue jean jacket. It looked nice, but once we got outside, she was going to be freezing. I also noticed that, for some reason, her hair was curlier than normal. I was still counting down my till when she walked in. Our new part-timer, a guy named Daniel, was taking over for me. When he looked up and saw her, he made a face like a hungry man at Thanksgiving dinner and said, "Damn, girl! You look good tonight. You got a hot date or something?" She smiled wide and said with a laugh, "No, just going to the carnival." "Really?" he said with doubt. "Well, whoever it is, he's very lucky. That's a really nice dress." "Thanks," she beamed. "It has pockets." I handed Daniel my countdown sheet to sign. Then I walked around to the other side of the counter and said, "I feel like I'm underdressed." She walked up to me, took my name tag off my chest, and stuffed it into my jacket pocket, then said cheerfully, "There, now you're perfect."
I could feel Daniel's eyes on us, but I shrugged it off and took my usual seat at the booth by the front door. Rosa took her spot across from me, and we made small talk until O'Brien walked in. She scanned the store and looked back at us and asked, "We still waiting on Goofy?" I told her we were, and she sat down in the booth next to me. Suddenly, I didn't feel so underdressed. O'Brien was sporting jeans and a navy Long Island University sweater, an obvious choice for a let's-keep-things-professional night out. Finally, Jerry staggered in. Rosa smiled and said, "I like your new shirt." He was wearing a plain white tee that read, "My name is Leroy, fight me." "Thanks," he responded. "I like your sexy dress." "Thanks, it has pockets." With the gang all together, we loaded up into the cruiser and made our way to the fairgrounds for the worst Valentine's Day ever. I'd like to go on the record as saying carnivals aren't nearly as much fun as anyone expects them to be. For some reason, when one thinks of carnivals, they tend to think about the rides and foods and spectacle. But they always seem to forget the long lines and the bad smells and aggressive carnival barkers. I guess good memories have a kind of filter. We stood in line for tickets while the temperature plummeted. Rosa started to shiver, but pretended she was okay, insisting it's really not that cold. As soon as we were done, I hit up the closest place that had hot coffee and got us all around. O'Brien was clearly in bodyguard mode the whole night, not daring to crack a smile or let down her guard lest any of the danger slip past and murder us all. Jerry passed his flask around, but Rosa was the only one to take a swig. "It's really not that cold, my ass." After we caffeinated up, Rosa asked what we wanted to do first. I scanned the lines and noticed that the shortest one was in front of the crappy little Haunted Hell House attraction. I figured we might as well, considering it was close by, and it might be a little warmer indoors. It was exactly the kind of silly spook fest you would have expected. The first room was full of snap animatronic machines that jump out and scream while a strobe light goes off. The next room was designed to look like a prison cell with a dummy in a blue jumpsuit attached to an electrical chair being electrocuted. I couldn't see the others' reactions in the poor lighting, but I was hoping they were getting some kind of enjoyment. I, on the other hand, was just trying to get through it. The next room was lit in all red, with white webbing covering the walls and a giant robot spider attached to the ceiling. Suddenly, I realized something was wrong. I looked towards Jerry to see if he noticed it too, but he just had a big, dumb smile on his face, blissfully unaware of the smell I noticed as soon as we walked into this room. It was bad. Bad enough that even the carnival funk couldn't drown it out. I looked around the room to try and find the source of that all-too-familiar scent of death, but there was nothing here. Guys. They couldn't hear me over the sound of spider screams and pushed through to the next room. I followed closely. It was much worse in here. This room was pitch black, save for a tiny trail of glowing mushrooms leading from the door of the spider room through this dark room and straight up to the door on the other side. Rosa grabbed me by the arm and squeezed tight as we started through the pitch black. A few steps in, the light snapped on, blinked sporadically to the sound of loud booming, and disappeared, leaving us in the dark again. I could see what they were going for, a strobe light effect to simulate lightning, and for a split second we saw that the room we were in was completely filled with dead bodies. It was almost too fast to really see, but there was gruesome gore and fake dismembered victims. Rosa laughed nervously. "That was pretty freaky," she whispered. I stopped walking. "Guys," I said again, a little louder. Rosa pulled at my arm. "Hey, let's keep going. This room smells terrible." I looked in the general direction of O'Brien and asked, "Amy?" The room was still completely dark. After a second of silence, she answered, "Yeah, I know." Rosa's voice cracked as she asked, "What's happening? Why are we stopped?" Jerry was the one to answer. That smells like a real dead body." The lightning effect went off again, and for another split second we saw the macabre room of death in all its horrible glory and gore. Dummies propped up to look like burn victims, stab victims, a bloodied soul torn in half at the torso lay in wide-eyed terror on the ground next to us.
And against the wall, there was a naked man nailed up with arms spread wide open like a perverted image of Jesus. His eyes were milky white and his bottom jaw was missing, but that wasn't enough to obscure him. Even in this condition, I knew who he was. The lights went out again. "Amy," I said again. I heard the sound of a click and knew immediately that she had just chambered a round into her service pistol. Rosa grabbed my hand and squeezed even tighter. Shit was about to get real. The lights clicked on at full blast, and for a short instant, I was completely blind. But then the door on the opposite side of the room slammed open, and a horrific clown bearing his unnatural razor-sharp teeth rushed in with a running chainsaw raised over his head, chuckling maniacally. O'Brien moved lightning fast, shielding the rest of us, and landing a solid punch to the center of the clown's face. He dropped the fake chainsaw and hit the ground on his back with a bounce. Rosa let out a long scream, and before any of us knew what had happened, O'Brien had him flipped over and handcuffed with her knee pressed into the center of his back. "Holy freaking hell," the clown squealed. "It's not a real chainsaw, you dumb bitch." "What the hell is going on?" begged Rosa. With the lights all switched on, I could finally see well enough to maneuver my crutches through the pile of fake dead bodies to the man nailed against the wall. The clown must have seen where I was headed and put things together. "Oh, shit," he said from his spot on the floor. "That wasn't there yesterday. You guys, I don't know how that got there. Hey, I just work here." Who is it?" Rosa asked. I looked right at him. I had to be 100% sure. "This is Farmer Jr." Once again, I'd like to apologize for the delayed follow-up. I had to take care of some things. Now, where did we leave off? Oh, right. I was trying to explain what happened at the carnival, and then someone came sneaking into the gas station through the back door. I didn't want to take any chances, so I grabbed my trusty baseball bat and slipped out from behind the counter. I could hear the guy breathing, sneaking around the snack racks on the chip aisle. A lot can be said about having the home field advantage, because even though he was smooth and quiet and heavily armed, I managed to slip up right behind him without ever giving myself away. He was wearing a camo jacket and had an ammo belt wrapped around his waist, and he was doing a crouch walk like some kind of soldier. Whoever he was, he'd come here looking for a fight. I got into striking position and raised my bat over my head, knowing I'd probably only get one shot at incapacitating him. But somehow, in the time it took for my bat to come down as fast as I could swing it, the man spun around and caught it in the palm of his gargantuan hand. I froze. That was so incredibly cool that I couldn't even come up with the correct reaction. Before I could find the words to say, the man stood up straight and yanked my weapon away from me. He towered over me, and the look on his face made it clear that he was royally pissed off. And rightfully so. I'd nearly given him another concussion, and all because I assumed he was there to kill me. "Oh," I said as the realization dawned on me, "it's you."
"Jack!" screamed Benjamin as he tossed my baseball bat behind him. "What the ever-loving hell is wrong with you?"
"Sorry. You had a mosquito. I was trying to get it before it..." He grabbed me by the neck and proceeded to drag me into the bathroom. For those of you new to the gas station, I suppose I should explain. Benjamin is a guy who showed up out of the blue a few months back. He's a big, muscular weirdo with a Duck Dynasty beard and a strange fascination with guns and knives. I have absolutely no idea who pays him, or where he came from, or what his deal is, but he's proven himself to be highly capable, if not overly trigger-happy, in case of supernatural pests. We're not exactly friends, but there is a certain level of professional courtesy between the two of us. Even though he almost intentionally blew me up one time, but that's a whole nother story. Benjamin filled the sink with cold water, grabbed me by the back of my neck with his gigantic monster-killing hands, and forced my face subaqueous. That was on my word of the day calendar a while back. And this is my first time to be able to use it in a sentence.
Yay.
I assumed he'd finally gone off the deep end, and this was his way of conserving ammo while putting me down. But like so many other near-death experiences, this one ended just a few seconds after I determined I was certain to die. He yanked me back out of the water, like a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. Then he tossed me to the ground. I hacked and spat and coughed until my throat was cleared enough for me to breathe normally. Then asked why.
I needed to get your blood flowing again. Your brain is mush and I can't work with you if you ain't got any sense left.
He crouched down next to me on the ground and smacked me across the face. Hard. Definitely harder than he needed to, I think. But who am I to question his methods? He's the expert.
Ow. How long have you been moping around this place all by yourself?
I tried to think, but couldn't exactly nail down the correct answer with any accuracy. More than a few weeks, less than 3 months. We'd run out of nearly every supply, and if the stack of overdue notices beneath the counter were to be believed, the phone and electric companies would be shutting off our utilities any day now. I'd been rotating through the same box of clothing for longer than I'd care to admit, washing them in the bathroom and hanging them out back to dry. At least until that guy in the bear costume stole my favorite pair of pants. Since then, I started leaving wet clothes on a drying rack in the supply closet. I looked Benjamin in the eyes and answered, "A while." He grabbed me by the collar before standing up and pulling me to my feet.
"All right, kid, do you still have any coffee in this dump?"
"As a matter of fact, we do."
"Good. Make sure you use bottled water and start us up a fresh pot. I'm going to go lock the doors and you can tell me what the hell happened. Sound good?"
In typical Benjamin fashion, he didn't wait for me to answer. He pulled out one of those fancy handguns that probably weighed as much as a small child, then went to secure the perimeter. I made the pot of coffee extra strong. Something told me we were going to need it. In 10 minutes, we were back in the booth by the door. Benjamin's idea of locking up involved chains and actual locks and pushing the new frozen drink machine flush against the doors so nobody could see in or out. I sipped my coffee. Benjamin gulped his down in 3 loud swallows.
"All right, you mentally unstable son of a bitch. Let's get on with it. What's going on this time? I got alarm bells going off left and right. All these reports keep tying back to your shithole of a town. I arrived yesterday and you know what I see? Nothing out of the ordinary. Place is perfect. Full of happy Stepford wives and smiling children and folks mowing their lawns. What am I missing?"
I tried taking a bigger sip of coffee just to see how hard that must have been for him to down it like that. But I ended up burning the roof of my mouth and instantly dropped it all back into the cup with an awkward blah. Benjamin narrowed his eyes at me. "If you'd seen this town before everything started, you'd already know what's wrong. People here don't mow, they don't smile, and they sure as hell can't be described as happy or perfect unless you're aiming for ironic."
"Okay," he said. "So what are we dealing with? Mind control? Something in the water?"
"I wish it were that simple."
"Then what is it?"
He was growing more impatient by the second. "It's an invasion. Those people you saw in town, they're not real." Benjamin laughed. It ended as abruptly as it started once he realized I was being serious, and the look of bemusement slid right off his face. "Elaborate on not real for me, please." Crap got weirder than usual, and now all the people in town have been replaced by something else. I could hear the sound of the seat beneath him creaking loudly as Benjamin leaned forward to ask,
"Well, then what happened to all the originals?"
"I don't know," I answered. "I assume they're all dead, but that might just be my irrational optimism." Benjamin looked around the store.
"Where are your friends?"
"Gone."
"Gone?"
"Yeah." He put his gigantic hand through his beard as he thought for a second, then said,
"All right, I'm gonna need you to dig real deep. I need you to pull yourself together for a little bit longer. And I need you to tell me exactly what happened here. Can you do that?"
"I can try."
"Good."
Benjamin made himself another cup of coffee. Then I explained how it all went down. First, I filled him in on the doctor trying to buy the gas station
and then Farmer Jr., and then the rest of the carnival. O'Brien let us know she was going to need to go to work. We just stumbled into an active crime scene and the viciously deconstructed body of an old frenemy nailed to a wall. She wanted to make sure we were going to be okay, but we had no good way to get out of there without her. I was the only sober one in the group. Rosa finished Jerry's flask to calm her nerves, and I still only had one leg and therefore couldn't operate a motor vehicle. O'Brien found an empty circus tent and told us to stay put there until her backup arrived to take over. We stood around in a covered 10x20 pop-up, trying hard to find something to say or do to pass the time. Jerry took out a pack of smokes and offered them to us. We both declined and watched as he lit one up. Eventually, Rosa broke her silence.
What? What do you think happened to him? You think he had some kind of accident while he was in there?
Jerry answered,
Oh yeah, probably. That guy was a huge klutz, always playing with nail guns and stuff.
I genuinely couldn't tell if he was being a sarcastic dick or if he was trying to tell a bad lie to help Rosa believe what she needed to, not to freak out even worse. Either way, I ruined it as soon as I spoke. FJ was missing his jawbone. No, somebody put him there. They wanted him to be found like that. Rosa began silently crying. Now I felt like the asshole, but she probably needed to know the truth. Our lives are weird and dangerous, and there's no room for innocent people in this town. I think Jerry actually said those exact words during Vanessa's funeral. Somebody coughed. We all looked at one another, and Jerry asked, Who was that? The sound had definitely come from inside the tent. I was really starting to regret that the only one in our group with any weapon and combat experience had left us alone in here, like sitting ducks. Knowing full well that Spencer Middleton was still out there somewhere, hunting me, why did I ever agree to come out here and do this in the first place? Jerry walked towards the back of the tent. Times like this are when I really wonder how this guy managed to stay alive for so long. Jerry! I called. He looked back at me and answered,
Don't worry. I'm just going to go investigate that mysterious noise coming from behind the strange curtain in the back of this dark tent next to the whorehouse where we found the dead body. I'll be right back.
Be careful, Rosa managed. Jerry reached the back of the tent and pulled away the thin curtain hanging there. In a small space on the other side, someone had tucked away a box covered in red fabric. It stood maybe 3 feet high and 3 feet wide. Jerry looked back our way. I started towards him with Rosa right behind me. Maybe we shouldn't be messing around in here, I offered. Before Jerry had a chance to respond, we heard a strange whimpering noise emanating from beneath the blanket. We all froze and stared at the box. That noise sounded almost human.
Yo, Jerry said. Is somebody in there?
We waited, but there was no response. Before I could suggest we turn around and pretend we didn't hear anything, Jerry grabbed the fabric by the corner and announced,
Well, I hope you're wearing pants!
I yelled out, Jerry, wait! But it was too late. He yanked the fabric off the top in one quick, smooth motion, uncovering what was underneath. And Rosa gasped. It was a cage, something akin to a dog kennel. Sitting inside, tucked away in the corner, was a small child, wearing nothing but a pair of strange shorts. The bottom of the cage was littered with blood and hay, with a half-empty bowl of water on one side. Jerry took a step back and muttered, Holy shit. The child calmly looked at each of us, one at a time, focusing for a few seconds before switching to the next. There was something a little off about the child, and I'm not just saying that because his eyes were freakishly huge and solid black, or because his skin was entirely purple. No, there was something harder to explain that was simply wrong about him. Assuming it was a him, given the lack of hair and the strange face, it really was nothing more than an educated guess. Eventually, Rosa broke free from the shock and rushed up to the cage, trying to find a way to open it, and saying to the child,
Oh my God, are you okay? You must be freezing. What's your name? Are you okay? How did you get in here? Guys, help me open this thing. Where are your parents? Oh my God. What are you doing in there? Are you all right?
She grabbed the bars of the cage and started shaking at them forcefully, but they were solid steel, and her tiny hands weren't going to do much to get through. Jerry calmly walked around her and crouched next to the cage, where the door was latched and secured with two separate heavy-duty locks. The kid didn't seem to mind either of them anymore. While they worked on his cage, he stared straight at me. "Hi," I said. "Hello." Wait. Did he just answer me? No, not possible. His mouth didn't move, and that noise certainly didn't come from inside the cage. Where did that voice come from, anyway? Sometimes I forget that my brain has a tendency to misfire. Jerry stood up. Yeah, it doesn't look like I'm getting through these locks. Rosa pulled off her blue jean jacket and squeezed it through the bars, screaming, "Who would leave a child out here like this?" She tried to throw her jacket onto the kid, but it landed near his feet and he simply looked at it, then back at me. "Okay, Jack," Jerry started. "What do we do?" "Why are you asking me?" "Well, you've got seniority." "I'm younger than you." "No, I mean gas station seniority. You outrank us, so you're the boss. Duh. What do we do?"
"Yeah, Jack. What do we do?" I looked down at the child. Did he just... For a split second, I swear I saw him crack a smile. "All right, you stay here with the purple kid. Make sure he's safe. I'm going to go find O'Brien." "Great. My moment to come up with a plan. And the best I can do is, let's split up, gang." "But seriously, like, what other options were there?"
"Be careful," Jerry warned as he put an arm around the shivering Rosa.
"I'm not trying to say that this isn't terribly interesting," interrupted Benjamin sarcastically. "But you've been talking for half an hour, and I still don't see what this has to do with any invasion. Have you forgotten what story you were telling?"
"Oh, I'm sorry. Am I boring you?"
"I just want you to get on with it."
"I'm trying, but this is important."
"Telling me about how Rosa was shivering? These details are important?"
"Yes, Benjamin. All of this is important."
"Okay, fine. Keep going. I'm all ears. Finish your damn story."
I refilled our coffees, then got back to it, right where I left off. I didn't make it far before regretting leaving the relative safety of the pop-up tent. The carnival was still in full swing, with visitors and carnies and performers walking about in a huge crowd, with plenty of spaces for Spencer or any other psychopath to be hiding in plain sight. This was a major event, and it would take a lot more than a simple murder to harsh this town's mellow. Sure, most of them didn't even know what had happened. Besides, a makeshift "closed for repairs" sign on the front of the Haunted Hell House attraction, the carnival was pretty much business as usual. I looked around to try and find O'Brien or any other members of the law enforcement community, but while I was scanning the crowds, somebody walked by and kicked one of my crutches out from under me, and I plummeted straight to the ground. I didn't get a look at them, but I heard their group laughing like that was the funniest thing they'd ever seen, and I caught a quick glimpse of two of them high-fiving as they walked away. I really hate people sometimes. As I struggled to right myself, I heard a deep southern voice ask, "You need some help there, son?" I looked up to see Dr. Howard walking towards me. With a big fluff of pink cotton candy in one hand, he extended his free arm to help me up. I positioned my crutches and said, "It's okay, I got this." I'd gotten pretty good at picking myself up off the ground. After I'd managed to get back to my feet, or rather, foot, the doctor took a bite of cotton candy, then said, "Mr. Townsend, what a strange coincidence running into you like this. What happened to all your friends?" I patted the dirt off my pants and answered, "Wouldn't you like to know?" He gave me a look, one that I'll never forget, almost like he felt sorry for me, and it really, really pissed me off. "Look, Jack, can I call you Jack? I guess. I feel like we got off on the wrong foot. I didn't mean that as a..." "It's fine. I get it." "I'm trying to say that first impressions are precious, aren't they? And I may have messed up.
I'd like to apologize for my rude behavior.
Don't mention it.
I started to move past him, but he took a step into my path. He wasn't ready to end our conversation.
Well, I suppose congratulations are in order.
What?
Well, I heard about what happened to the previous owners. For that, you certainly have my condolences. But when life closes one door, you know the expression, I think you've been given a terrific, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This kind of responsibility, though, it's not to be taken lightly. And I want to make sure that you're not being given the wrong kind of advice. I'm a businessman, after all, and I've seen plenty of people in your position lose everything just because they didn't know who to trust.
I rolled my eyes hard enough that there was no way he couldn't see it, and then said, "Thanks." As I tried to take a step around him, he blocked my path once more.
I mean, what did your friends say when you told them?
I locked eyes with the doctor. He read my silence and knew why I wasn't answering. He let out a good, deep chuckle and said,
"Oh, you haven't told them, have you?"
I was waiting for the right time. Why was I even answering this guy? I didn't owe him anything.
"You haven't told your friends that the owners left you the gas station in their will?"
"No."
"How interesting."
He picked a tiny tuft of cotton candy off the stick and tucked it into his mouth, then licked his fingers one at a time before repeating himself.
"How interesting."
"Look, it's just not important."
"If it's not important, then why didn't you tell them?"
"I don't know."
"What is it about you gas station employees and keeping secrets? You, Jerry, that other guy?"
"Hey, I know all about Jerry's past."
The doctor laughed.
"No, you don't."
"Yes, I do. I know he's secretly rich and ran away to join a cult and his parents are looking for him."
"Wow. If that's what you think his secret is, then I've got news for you. You don't know your friend nearly as well as you think you do."
"Well, this has been lovely," I said, trying once again to move around the doctor. "But I've got to get going. I found an abandoned child, and now I need to get the authorities."
That wiped the smug look right off the doctor's face.
"An abandoned child? Where? Here?"
I started maneuvering through the crowd, but the doctor kept along right next to me.
"Yeah, so what do you care?"
"Jack, I'm not a monster. If there's a child that needs help, I'm going to do what I can. I know the owner of this venue, and child endangerment will not stand."
He put his fingers to his mouth and let out an incredibly loud, shrill whistle, then yelled at someone I couldn't see, "Hey, Felix, over here!"
A few seconds later, a pasty security guard with a porn star mustache and a name badge that read F. Gabriel cut through the crowd to reach us.
"Yes, Mr. Howard?"
"Felix, this young man says he found a child in need of help. I need this situation to be rectified yesterday. Do you understand? I'm holding you personally responsible for this."
"Yes, Mr. Howard."
"Hold up,"
Benjamin said, interrupting my story yet again.
"What?"
"I gotta go take a piss and then check a perimeter. Something tells me this story is going to be much longer than I had anticipated. You gonna be okay and not go crazy until I get back?"
"I can try."
"Good."
And that pretty much brings us up to where we are now. Benjamin is walking around the building. I have no idea what he thinks he's looking for, but I figured I'd make the most of my time by writing this update until he gets back.
Come to think of it, he's been out there for a while. I wonder what's taking him so long.
Well, when he does get back, I'm going to have to tell him the rest of the story. I'm not really looking forward to it. I know he has an open mind and everything, but, well, things are about to get really weird. And I don't blame anyone if they don't believe me, or if they hate me for what happens next. I just want to let you all know, right now, that I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry for what happens next.
Hey, guys. I suppose I should apologize again for leaving you all hanging like that. Wow. I sure do start off a lot of these updates with apologies, don't I? Sorry about that. I assure you I am not dead, not yet anyway, but that might be about to change soon.
From what I've been able to gather, the invasion is spreading like the plague, and all I can do to slow it down is sit here all by myself and hold my ground until that's no longer possible. Alone. Without any help. Jeez. I always planned on dying alone, but I never realized it was going to be so utterly lonely. Okay, the severed head in the box took umbrage with that last sentence. I didn't realize he was reading along with my thoughts, so please allow me to clarify. I'm not literally alone. If I were, this whole thing might actually be a little easier. There's the box head, plus my trusty baseball bat. I drew a face on him with a Sharpie and named him Ricardo. And of course, old killaholic Benjamin just showed up out of the blue. And you know, I've got you guys. But the truth is, I can't know how many of you out there are real either. The severed head can't sniff out the imposters unless they're in the gas station. I have to accept that there is a very real chance none of you are real either. Maybe the invasion has already succeeded. Maybe I'm the last real person left. But for the sake of my sanity, let's just assume this isn't the case. I guess the last time I checked in, Benjamin had just arrived at the gas station and found me in a somewhat embarrassing state. He barricaded our doors, just like the good old days, and then I started telling him all about everything that has happened in the last few months. I told him about Valentine's Day and Farmer Brown's son's murder at the carnival. I was about to get to the really weird stuff, but then he left to check the perimeter. Benjamin came back into the gas station a while later, and the head in the box verified that it was the same Benjamin that had walked out moments earlier. He had fresh claw marks all over his boots. Nothing too serious. Apparently, he ran into Rocco by the grease trap. Fun fact, Rocco is still alive. I swear that raccoon will outlive all of us. Benjamin resecured the back door and took his regular seat in the booth across from me, and I got back to telling my story. I left my friends with the mysterious purple-skinned child in the cage and went to go find someone who could help. Instead, all I found was Dr. Bad Accent Howard and a rent-a-cop named Felix. Felix assured me that he'd taken care of the mysterious caged child and insisted that it was nothing for us to worry about. Before I could press him any further, he called over his buddy, an angry-looking state trooper, who was in town helping out with the carnival detail, to ask a few questions and take my official statement. I tried explaining how we'd found the child trapped in a cage in the unattended tent, but for some reason the trooper kept blowing off those perfectly valid concerns. He seemed way more interested in asking about me and my relationship with FJ. How long had we known each other? Were we friends? Enemies? Was there bad blood? Did I have a grudge against him? Was I faking my injury? Did I own any weapons? I kept pointing out that FJ wasn't getting any deader, and we should probably return to the random kid who definitely needed some hot cocoa and a pair of pants. But before I knew it, I was being escorted to the back of a police car. Once we got there, he handcuffed me, yoinked my crutches and phone, and slammed the door. I spent the next hour trapped back there, cold and alone, wondering what I did or said that landed me in this situation, and also wondering what happened to the trooper. Had he forgotten about me? Or was he doing this to make some kind of point? I tried getting comfortable, but it was exactly as difficult as you'd expect with no heat and wrists bound behind my back. It seems you found yourself in another tight spot. I looked around for a second, trying to discover who had just said that. Then a face turned back from the passenger seat and stared at me with sad eyes. Oh, I said. Hi, Tom. I didn't realize you were here. I'm not, he assured me, but I still wanted to check on you. Well, I appreciate the company, and it's nice that you chose to stop by, but that doesn't really help me right now. You got any plans for how you're going to get out of this mess? I figured I'd just wait until someone rescued me. That's what I usually do, and it's been working out okay so far. Tom sighed and turned back in his seat. That isn't going to work much longer, Jack. You've been coasting by on luck, but things are about to change for the worse.
There's a storm brewing.
Yeah, I said as I tried to wriggle into a position where I could actually see my old friend. I've actually noticed quite an uptick recently in dead people talking to me. Tom didn't respond. I scooted forward to try and catch a glimpse of him through the cage divider separating me from the front seats. But once I got into position, I could see that there was nobody there. I was alone again. Or, more likely, I was alone still. That's how I stayed for another hour or two, until the door opened with a blast of cool night air. I heard a welcome voice on the other side ask, "You all right, Tripod?" I looked out to see O'Brien and the angry trooper. "I'm fine." "Uncuff him," she commanded. When the trooper didn't move fast enough, she yelled, "Now!" That got him into gear. He removed the cuffs and handed me my cell phone and crutches, helped me out, and did pretty much everything but dust me off. "Now apologize," ordered O'Brien. I turned to face the trooper, who was now looking at the ground sheepishly. Then I said, "I'm sorry." He looked up and cocked his head slightly. "Not you, dummy. Him." "Oh." The trooper cleared his throat and forced his way through a half-hearted apology, and then that was the end of it. He got into the car and drove off, while she walked with me back to the haunted hell house, through an empty carnival. All the booths were closed up, and all the people had long gone. Apparently, I had been sitting in the back of that cop car for longer than I had originally estimated. "I thought I told you to stay put." She was angry, but there was a real note of concern in her voice. "I know, but there was a, well, I'm not sure what you'd call it, a kid or something, in a cage." "Yeah, I heard, but you still shouldn't have gone off on your own like that. What if Spencer had been following us? What if he'd gotten you before I did?" "Well, I guess I'd probably be dead. Or worse." "You need to start taking this seriously. You know what's out there. You know better than anyone. And you won't even carry a weapon. I never should have let you come out tonight." I stopped in my tracks. "Whoa, let me come out tonight? Amy, you're not my mom. Or my boss. Now, don't get me wrong, I appreciate all the times you've saved my skin. But I don't need your permission to leave." She interrupted. "I didn't mean it like that." But it was a little too late for her to backtrack now. I knew exactly what she meant. "I'm not your responsibility. Someone's got to keep you safe. I can keep myself safe." "I just pulled you out of the back of a state trooper's car. Somebody's out there hunting monsters and opening gates to hell. You've been kidnapped more times in the last month than I can believe. Now bodies are piling up again, and you won't even carry a gun." Well, I'm glad we could have that nice, neat little recap there. "Whether you believe it or not, I care about your stupid ass, and I'd like for you to stick around for as long as possible. I want you to be more careful." "Is that an order or a request?" "Call it both. As your friend, I'm asking you to please watch out. As a deputy, I'm telling you I'll kick your ass if you don't start acting smarter." Before I could say anything back, a voice from near the hell house called out, "O'Brien!" We both looked up to see a man dressed in the deputy uniform, holding a pretzel as he walked up to us, his powerful gut seriously testing the limits of his shirt button's capabilities. Soon he was close enough to smell. His name tag said, "Love." "Clyde wants to talk to you," he said to her. O'Brien tried to hide a quick scowl, but failed. "All right, I'm on my way." She looked back at me. "Can we finish this conversation later?" "I thought we already had." She scowled again. What was I supposed to say? She turned to the deputy and said, "Love, do me a favor and walk crutches back to my car." Then to me. "I told Pockets and Stoner to wait in the cruiser while I went to find you. Stay with them where it's safe until I get back, okay?" So weird that she would still think that any place in this town was safe. Deputy Loved walked with me towards the parking lot for all of about 10 seconds before giving up and saying, "You got this, right?" "What? I mean, you're a big boy. You know where the parking lot is. No reason you need a chaperone, is there?" "Well, besides all those crazy reasons." "No, I'm fine. Go enjoy your pretzel." Love had already stuffed the entire thing into his mouth hole before I could finish the sentence.
Then he turned and toddled off. By the time I got back to the huge empty field that served as the carnival's parking arena, it was empty save for a few police cars and a single ambulance. I made my way across the field towards O'Brien's cruiser, navigating the potholes and litter and empty beer cans strewn about the area. When I was a few yards away, I noticed that Jerry and Rosa were sitting on the hood of the cruiser, staring into the woods with their backs to me. They'd found, or more likely stolen, a blanket from somewhere and were wrapped up in it. Once I got close enough to hear them, I picked up a part of a conversation I really wish I hadn't. Rosa seemed annoyed and somewhat drunk. "I don't get it, you know? I don't know what I did to make him not like me so much." "Hey, I know the world doesn't revolve around Jack." I told myself to check my ego before assuming that she was talking about me. I mean, that could describe anyone, right? Jerry answered her in a voice that was much softer than I was used to. "Yeah, I know what you mean. There's a wall there. Most of the people he lets get close to him either die or try to kill him, or usually both." Okay, that settled it. They were definitely talking about me. I considered clearing my throat to announce my presence, but for some reason I didn't. Instead, I just stood there, listening, like a creep. Jerry took a swig from a wine bottle and continued, "If it helps any, I don't think he likes me very much either." Wow. Suddenly, I felt pretty damn small. In the days and weeks and months since that night, I've wished countless times for one chance to go back to that moment, so I could kick my own ass for not saying something, for not telling them that, "Hey, I really do like you guys." Instead, I ignored it. I took Jerry's sentence and buried it deep in my mind, where I thought it would be safe and do no harm. Little did I realize that it wasn't going to just sit there. It would eventually start to leak, poisoning my other thoughts, long after Jerry was gone. I assumed I'd get a chance to bring it up again later, when I was ready, when I wasn't standing in a field in the middle of the night, cold and hungry and annoyed. But life doesn't guarantee us any extra chances, does it? Maybe we should seize the ones we get. I took a breath to say, "Hey guys," but my timing was just a little off. Before I could get the words out, Jerry and Rosa leaned in and started kissing each other.
"Look, I don't need to hear this part," Benjamin interrupted. He was really starting to annoy me with all these interruptions. "Imagine how I feel, having to talk about it. I swear, seeing them kiss felt completely wrong and unnatural, like seeing your parents kissing. I'd love to forget all about it, but you were the one who asked."
"Are you seriously going to sit there and tell me with a straight face that I need to hear about your friend's romantic drama in order to understand why this town is ground central for an invasion?"
"Yes. Yes, I am. That is exactly what I'm saying."
"Okay, then," he said flatly. "Please carry on. I can't wait to see where this is going."
It was unexpected, although I don't know why it should have been. Jerry has a long history of kissing anybody who lets him. And Rosa? Well, I don't know. The whole thing kind of messed me up a little. But one thing was for sure. I couldn't just stand there watching them like some kind of weirdo pervert. I had to say something. But then I realized that they weren't in front of me anymore. In fact, the car had completely vanished, replaced by a tangle of old trees and knee-high weeds. What in the wide world of sports? I turned and looked around, taking it all in, my mind falling through the void, thrashing around and trying to find some kind of handhold. Where am I? And utterly failing. Until my eyes caught something familiar, way off in the distance, on the other side of the field. It was O'Brien's cruiser. From here, I could barely make out two figures sitting on the hood, staring at the trees on the other side. Had they just teleported? I looked at the ground to see a tiny garden snake slithering over my foot and into the bushy weeds. Then it finally clicked. No, they hadn't teleported. I was somehow on the opposite side of the parking area, with no idea how I'd gotten there. Lost time is one of my rarer symptoms.
and I hadn't experienced it in a while. Not since the old digging episodes. I was hoping that I might have gotten lucky, that maybe I'd gotten over that particular ailment, but I guess not. My subconscious self must have decided that it was a good idea to walk away from everything, from the carnival and my friends, and head
new on Curiosity Stream, Darwin's Theory of Evolution, a scientific breakthrough, but 1920s Tennessee wasn't ready for it.
It became the Bible versus evolution.
Followed a heated trial that changed American education forever on Monkey in the Middle. And it's the country's deadliest highway.
There were something like 178 accidents in a two-year period.
Don't miss the most dangerous road in America. Watch now on Curiosity Stream. Annual plans are $20, just $1.67 a month. Visit curiositystream.com.